I returned to Plympton bearing my certificate and thinking that now everything would be plain sailing. But it was not to be. I applied for a job in Birmingham, and I went to Birmingham to Lozils for interview. There I was told that I couldn't get the job because I was not a resident of that county. Back to Plympton I went and tried for a job in Plymouth. But the Plymouth City Council would not employ me for much the same reason, except I was in the right county, but not in the right city. So it went on, and after a few years like this in which I did anything that I could do anything to bring in enough money to keep body and soul together and to keep me in some sort of clothing, my father died. He had been in very poor health for years. Most of the time he had been in bed, and about a year before he died his business had been sold off and the shop had been made into a doctor's surgery. The glass windows were painted green and the shop itself was the surgery, with our living part being used as the consulting room and dispensary. My mother and I lived in what had been our workrooms. But after father's death the doctor combined decided to move to a fresh area, and so we would have no income at all. My health was not at all good, so my mother went to her daughter, my sister, and I had been a prize student of a correspondence college, so I got a job with a surgical appliance firm in Perry Vale, Middlesex. I was appointed first as works manager, but when the owner of the firm found that I could write good advertising copy, then he made me advertising manager as well. I had to take courses in surgical fitting, and after that I became a surgical fitter consultant. I was considered so good at this work that I was moved from Perry Vale to the heart of London, and I was the chief fitter in the London offices. Just before I left work at the London offices, war was declared between England and Germany. Everything was blacked out, and I found the journey to London from Perry Vale and back every day to be absolutely exhausting. It tried my strength to the utmost, and during this time I got married. Well, I do not propose to say anything about this because I understand that the press on earth have already said too much, nearly all of it untrue. I have been asked to talk about my life, so I will confine myself strictly to my life. We could not continue to live in Perry Vale because conditions in travelling were too bad, so we managed to find an apartment in the Knightsbridge area of London. It was a blessing to be able to go on the tube every day to my office. The war was hotting up, things were becoming difficult, and there was heavy rationing and food shortages. Bombs were dropping heavily on London. Much of my time was spent on fire watch. I had to climb rusty iron ladders going to the top of buildings and watch out for approaching German bombers, and if I saw them in time I had to give warning to the work people below. One day I was riding through Hyde Park on my bicycle going to work, and I saw bombers approaching. One dropped bombs which seemed as if they were going to come uncomfortably close to me, so I dropped my bicycle and ran for some trees. The bombs fell, they missed the park and landed in Buckingham Palace, where they did a fair amount of damage. Everywhere, it seemed, bombs were dropping. One day I was having to go out on a special surgical fitting case and was approaching Charing Cross Station when suddenly a great bomb dropped out of the clouds, went into the station and right through the station to the underground, which was crowded with people. I can see even now the cloud of dust and scattered pieces of what? That was blown out of the hole in the station roof. One night there was a terrific air raid and the place where my wife and I lived was bombed. We had to get out in the night just as we were. For a long time we wandered about in the darkness, other people were wandering about as well, everything was chaotic. Bombs were dropping and the sky was lurid with the flames of the burning East End. We could see St. Paul's Cathedral outlined in flame, and great clouds of smoke went up. Every so often we would hear the rat-tat-tat of machine gun fire, and occasionally spent cartridges would fall down around us. Everywhere there was shrapnel falling, and we wore our steel helmets caused the smoking fragments hurtling down would have gone through an unprotected body. At last the dawn came, and I phoned my employer to say that I had been bombed out. He said, "Never mind about that, you must come to work. Other people are bombed out too." So, dirty and hungry, I got on a train and went to my office. At the approach of our street there I found that it was cordoned off. I tried to go past the barrier, but a most officious policeman came up and accused me of looting. Tempers were quite rough at that time. Just at that moment my boss stepped out of a car and came up to me. He showed his identification papers to the policeman and together we crossed the barrier and went to our office. Water was rushing out of everywhere. The place had been hit by a bomb and the water supply had been broken to shards. From the roof, many floors above, water was cascading over the stock. The basement was neck deep in water and everywhere there was glass, everywhere there were stone fragments, and we turned and found a bomb casing lodged in a wall. It was a state of chaos. There was not much worth saving. We managed to get out some records and just a few pieces of equipment and we all set to and tried to clean up the place a bit, but it was hopeless. There was no chance of getting the place working again. Eventually my employer said he was going to move to another part of the country, and he invited me to accompany him. I could not do so because I hadn't the money. It was very difficult indeed to buy things, and to have to set up a fresh home in some remote part of the country was an expense which I just could not contemplate. So because I was unable to go, I was out of a job, unemployed in England in wartime. I went to various labor exchanges trying to get any employment. I tried to become a wartime policeman, but I could not pass the medical examination. Conditions were becoming desperate. One cannot live on air, and as a last resort I went to the offices of the correspondence school where I had taken so many courses. It just so happened that they wanted a man. Some of their own men had been called up, and I had, so I was told, an enviable record, and so I was told that I could be given a job in the advisory department. The pay would be £5 a week and I would have to live at Weybridge in Surrey. No, they said, they couldn't advance anything to help me get there. I would have to go there first for interview with one of the directors. So I made inquiries and found that the cheapest way was by Green Line bus, so on the appointed day I went to Weybridge, but there was a terrific wait. The director had not come in. I was told, oh, he never comes in the time he says. He might not be in until 4 o'clock. You'll just have to wait. Well, eventually the director did come in. He saw me and he was quite affable, and he offered me the job at £5 a week. He told me there was an unoccupied Fiat over the garage and I could have this by paying what was really quite a high rent, but I was in a hurry to get employment, so I agreed to his terms. I returned to London and we got our poor things, such as they were, to Weybridge, up the worn old wooden steps to the flat above the garages. The next day I started my work as a correspondence clerk, which is what it really was, to a correspondence school. There are such a lot of highfalutin terms. We now have garbage collectors called sanitation experts when all they are is garbage collectors. Some of the correspondence clerks call one themselves advisory consultants or careers consultants. But still all we did was correspondence clerk's duties. It seems to be a crime to be of a certain category. I have always been told that my father was a plumber. Actually, he wasn't, but what if he had been? Certainly he served an apprenticeship as a plumber, but, like me, he had no choice. I served an apprenticeship as a motor engineer. And anyway, how about the famous Mr. Crapper? The gentleman who invented water closets as they are today. They have not been improved since the day of old Crapper. Crapper, if you remember, was a plumber, a jolly good one, too, and his invention of the flush tank and the flush toilet endeared him to King Edward, who treated Mr. Crapper as a personal friend. So, you see, a plumber can be a friend of royalty just as can a grocer. Thomas Lipton was alleged to be a grocer. Certainly he was. He had a big grocery firm, and he was a friend of King George V. Surely it doesn't matter what a person's father was. Why is it such a disgrace to have a parent who was a tradesman? Nowadays daughters of royalty are married to tradesmen, aren't they? But I am always amused because Jesus, it is said, was the son of a carpenter. How was that a disgrace? Well, all this is taking me a long way from my story, but I will just say here and now that I would rather be the son of a plumber than the son of those poor sick people who call themselves pressmen. To me there is no sicker job than that of pressman. A plumber clears up the messes of people. A pressman makes messes of people. Since I have been over here I have found various things of interest, but one thing in particular which intrigues me is this: I bear quite an honored name, not merely through Uncle Richard but through others who went before him, one who was a colleague of Sir Joshua Reynolds, and another was the Lord Lieutenant, or whatever they call one him, of the Tower of London. And it was at the time when an attempt was made to steal the crown jewels, an attempt which was thwarted. There is much to see over here, much to learn, and I am told I have a lot yet to learn because, they say, I have not learned humility, not yet learned how to get on with people. Well, I am doing my best in dictating all this stuff, which I will swear upon a stack of Bibles is the truth and nothing but the truth. Chapter 9. Life at Weybridge was not happy. I became an air raid warden. One other warden became very jealous and did everything he could to cause me harm. I offered to resign, but it was not wanted for me to resign. One night there was an air raid while I was at Weybridge, and after the air raid a policeman came to the door. It seemed that a small light, hardly large enough for anyone to notice from 100 feet away, was showing. There was a faulty switch in the flat, on the landing. It was one of those old brass switches with a great knob, and I suppose the vibration caused by the banging and all that, had shaken it just to the on position. The policeman could see for himself that if I fly sneeze the light would come on because the spring in the tumbler was defective, but, no. The light was showing, that's all there was to it. So there was a court appearance and a fine. And that is a thing I have resented ever since because it was so utterly unnecessary, and the enemy warden was the one who had reported it. After that I resigned from the ARP believing that if people could not work together then it was better to break up the party. At Weybridge I was supposed to do everything, answer letters, and persuade people to take correspondence courses, maintain the boss's cars, and he was always changing the darn things, act as unpaid messenger boy and do anything which came to hand. All for £5 a week. People were getting called up, conditions were becoming more difficult, food was getting shorter and shorter, and from the aircraft factory at Brooklands there were always strange noises. One day a Wellington was being flight tested and it crashed just beside the village of Weybridge. The pilot saved the village at the cost of his own life because he crashed that plane upon the electrified railway line. The plane was like a toy that had been snapped into 1,000 pieces. It was scattered all over the place, but the people of Weybridge were saved because of the self-sacrifice of the pilot. Just at this time I received my call-up papers. I had to go before a board of medical examiners as a formality before entering one of the services. On the appointed day I went to the great hall where there were crowds of other men waiting to be examined. I said to an attendant there, "I've had TB, you know." He looked at me and said, "You look a bit of a wreck, I must say, lad. Sit over there." So I sat where directed, and I sat, and I sat. Eventually, when nearly everyone else in the place had been examined, the panel of doctors turned to me. "What's this?" said one. "You say you've got TB. Do you know what TB is?" "I certainly do, sir," I said. "I've had it." He asked me a lot of questions and then grumped and grumped. Then he had a word with his associates. At last he turned back to me as if he was making the greatest decision in the world. "I am sending you to Kingston Hospital," he said. "They will examine you there. They will soon find out if you've got TB or not, and if you haven't, God help you." He carefully filled out a form, sealed it, put it in another envelope and sealed that, and then flung it at me. I picked it off the floor and made my way home. Next day I told my employer that I had to go to hospital for examination. He appeared absolutely bored. I got the impression that he thought, "Oh, why does the fellow waste my time? Why doesn't he join up and get out of my sight?" However, I got through my work that day, and the day after, as directed, I took the bus to Kingston on Thames. I made my way to a hospital there. I had all sorts of tests and then I was x-rayed. After the x-ray I was shoved in a drying cupboard where a lot of wet x-rays were hung up to dry out. After half an hour a woman came and said, "Okay, you can go home." That was all, nothing more was said, so I just went home. Next there came a summons to go to the TB clinic at Weybridge. Of course, this was about 3 or 4 weeks later, but the summons came and off I went to the TB clinic like a good little boy. By now I was heartily sick of the whole affair. At the TB clinic I was seen by a most wonderful doctor who was indeed all that a doctor should be. He had my x-rays there, and he agreed with me that it was utterly stupid that I should be shunted from one department to another. He said it was perfectly obvious that I had bad lung scars through TB, and, he said if I got in the army, I would be a liability, not an asset. Surely England hadn't come to a state when they are called upon to enlist those who are obviously ill. I shall send a report in to say that you are unfitted for service of any kind, he said. Time went by, and at last I received a card in the post telling me that I could not be required for military service because I was classed as grade 4, the lowest grade there was. I took the card to my employer and showed it to him, and he seemed to think that, well, he'd got somebody to carry on with the work if all the others were called up. There was a frantic scramble in those days of people trying to get deferment. Everybody was trying to get deferment. The man who was manager under the employer left to get another job, and another man was appointed as manager, but he and I didn't get on at all, we just did not at all. He was of a type that I thoroughly disliked, and I seemed to be of a type that he thoroughly disliked. However, I did the best I could, but things were becoming more and more difficult because there was more and more work without any increase in pay. It was obvious that someone was rushing around to the employer telling tales, etc., not necessarily true tales either. One day after work I was just meandering through the garden. We had a garden of 3.5 acres and I was passing through a little wooded copse. It was evening and growing dusk. Somehow I tripped over an exposed root and went down with a horrible thonk. Literally it jerked me out of myself. I stood upright, but then God bless my soul. I found that I wasn't me because I was standing upright and my body was lying flat on its face. I looked about in utter amazement, and I saw some strange-looking people around me. Monks, I thought, what the devil are monks doing here? I looked at them, and I looked at, well, I suppose it was my body on the ground. But then I got a voice or something in my head. First I had the impression that it was some strange foreign lingo, but as I thought about it I discovered that I could understand what was being said. Young man, the voice said in my head, you are thinking of an evil matter, you are thinking of doing away with your life. That is a very bad thing indeed. Suicide is wrong, no matter the cause, no matter the imagined reason or excuse, suicide is always wrong. All right for you, I thought, you haven't any troubles like I have. Here I am in this well. I had an awful job not to put in words the exact description of the place, and I can't get a rise, and my boss seems to have taken a dislike to me, why should I stay here? There are plenty of trees about and a nice rope to throw over. But I am not saying too much about this because a thought was put in my mind saying that if I wanted to I could get release from what I considered to be the tortures of earth. If I wanted to, if I was really serious, I could do something for mankind by making my body available to some ghost or spirit which wanted to hop in almost before I had hopped out. It seemed a lot of rubbish to me. But I thought I would give it a whirl and let them talk on. First, they said, as a sign of genuine interest, I had to change my name. They told me a strange name they wanted me to adopt, but well, I told my wife only that I was going to change my name. She thought I was a bit mad or something and let it go at that, and so I did change my name quite legally. Then my teeth started giving trouble. I had a horrible time. At last I couldn't stick it any longer and I went to a local dentist. He made an attempt to extract the tooth but it wouldn't come. He made a hole in the thing so he could use an elevator, not the type people use to travel to different floors, but the type which is meant to elevate a tooth by leverage. This dentist got on the phone to some specialist in London, and I had to go to a nursing home in a hurry. My wife told my employer that I had to go to a nursing home, and she was met with the statement, well, I have to work when I have toothache. And that was all the sympathy we got. So I went to this nursing home, at my own expense. Of course, there was no such thing as health schemes like you seem to have now, and I had this little operation which was not so easy after all. The dentist was good. The anaesthetist was even better. I stayed in the nursing home a week and then returned to Weybridge. There were quite a number of unpleasant little incidents, needlings and all that sort of thing, and unjust accusations. There is no point in going into all the details, raking up muck, because, after all, I'm not a pressman. But there were false accusations, so my wife and I talked it over and we decided that we couldn't stick it any longer, so I handed in my notice. From that moment I might have been a leper, or I might have had an even worse form of plague, because for the rest of the week I sat in my office, no one came to see me, they apparently had been told not to, and no work of any kind was given to me. I just stayed there like a convict serving out time. At the end of the week that was it, I was finished. We left Weybridge with joy and we went to London. We moved about a bit, oh gracious, I forget how many places we tried, and anyway it doesn't matter. But then we found that conditions were intolerable and we moved on to another place, a suburb of London called Thames Ditton. Oh, I am so anxious to get this silly affair over because I do not enjoy talking about this, but I was in such a hurry that I have forgotten one bit. Here it is, I had been told some time before that I would have to grow a beard. Well, I thought, what's it matter? Just as well be hung for a sheep as a lamb, so while I was at Weybridge I grew this beard and was jeered at quite a bit by my employer and by those who worked with me. Never mind, I thought, I wouldn't be with them much longer. We moved to Thames Ditton. For a very short time we stayed in a lodging house which was run by a funny old woman who just could not see dirt. She thought she lived in a ducal mansion, or something, and was quite incapable of seeing immense cobwebs high up in the corners of the stairway. But she was too ladylike and so we looked for another place. Down the road there was such a place, a house which was being rented as an upper and lower flat. We took the place, we had no thought of how we were going to get money because I had no job, no job at all. Instead I was just doing anything to earn odd bits of money to keep us alive. I went to the unemployment exchange but because I had left my employment instead being fired I was not able to get any unemployment benefit. So that never have I had any unemployment money, I managed without. To this day I don't know how, but I did. I had an old bicycle and I used to ride around trying to get work, but no, no work was available. The war had ended, men had come back from the forces, and the labor market was saturated. It was all right for them, they had unemployment benefit and perhaps a pension, I had nothing. Then one night I was approached by a group of men. They hoisted me out of my body, and talked to me. And they asked me if I still wanted to get out of my body into what I then thought was paradise. I suppose it is paradise, but these people called it the astral world. I assured them I wanted to get out even more than before, so they told me that the very next day I must stay at home. One man, he was all done up in a yellow robe, took me to the window and pointed out. He said, "That tree, you must go to that tree and put your hands up on that branch, and go to pull yourself up and then let go." He gave me the exact time at which I must do this, telling me it was utterly vital to follow instructions to the letter, otherwise I would have a lot of pain, and so would other people. But worse, for me I would still be left on the earth. The next day my wife thought I had gone bonkers or something because I didn't go out as usual, I pottered about. And then a minute or two before the appointed time I went out into the garden and walked over to the tree. I pulled on a branch of ivy, or whatever it is that ivy has, and reached up to the branch as directed. And then I felt as if I had been struck by lightning. I had no need to pretend to fall, I did full whack down. I fell down, and then, good gracious me, I saw a silver rope sticking out me. I went to grab it to see what it was but gently my hands were held away. I lay there on the ground feeling horribly frightened because two people were at that silver rope, and they were doing something to it, and a third person was there with another silver rope in his hand, and, horror of horrors, I could see through the whole bunch of them, so I wondered if I was seeing all this or if I had dashed my brains out, it was all so strange. At last there was a sucking sort of noise and a plop. And then I found, oh joy of joy, I was floating free in a beautiful, beautiful world, and that means that having gone so far I fulfilled my part of the contract. I have said all I am going to about my past life, and now I am going back to my own part of the astral world. I am Lobsang Rampa, and I have finished transcribing that which was so unwillingly, so ungraciously, told to me by the person whose body I took over. Let me continue where he left off. His body was upon the ground, twitching slightly, and I confess without too much shame, that I was twitching also, but my twitches were caused by fright. I didn't like the look of this body stretched out there in front of me, but a Lama of Tibet follows orders, pleasant orders as well as unpleasant ones, so I stood by while two of my brother Lamas wrestled with the man's silver cord. They had to attach mine before his was quite disconnected. Fortunately, the poor fellow was in an awful state of daze, and so he was quiescent. At last, after what seemed hours but actually was only about a fifth of a second, they got my silver cord attached and his detached. Quickly he was led away, and I looked at that body to which I was now attached and shuddered. But then, obeying orders, I let my astral form sink down on that body which was going to be mine. Ooh, the first contact was terrible, cold, and slimy. I shot off in the air again in fright. Two lamas came forward to steady me, and gradually I sank again. Again I made contact, and I shivered with horror and of repulsion. This truly was an incredible, a shocking experience, and one that I never want to undergo again. I seemed to be too large, or the body seemed to be too small. I felt cramped, I felt I was being squeezed to death, and the smell. The difference. My old body was tattered and dying, but at least it had been my own body. Now I was stuck in this alien thing and I didn't like it a bit. Somehow, and I cannot explain this, I fumbled about inside trying to get hold of the motor nerves of the brain. How did I make this confounded thing work? For a time I lay there just helpless, just as if I were paralyzed. The body would not work. I seemed to be fumbling like an inexperienced driver with a very intricate car. But at last, with the help of my astral brothers, I got control of myself. I managed to make the body work. Shakily I got to my feet, and nearly screamed with horror as I found that I was walking backwards instead of forwards. I teetered and fell again. It was indeed a horrendous experience. I was truly nauseated by this body and was in fear that I should not be able to manage it. I lay upon my face on the ground and just could not move. Then from the corner of an eye I saw two lamas standing by, looking highly concerned at the difficulty I was having. I growled, "Well, you try it for yourself, see if you can make this abominable thing do what you tell it to do." Suddenly one of the lamas said, "Lobsang, your fingers are twitching, now try with your feet." I did so, and found that there was an amazing difference between Eastern and Western bodies. I never would have thought such a thing possible. But then I remembered something I had heard while a ship's engineer: for ships in Western waters the propeller should rotate in one direction, and for Eastern waters it should rotate in the opposite direction. "It seems clear to me," I said to myself, "that I've got to start out all over again." So I kept calm and let myself lift out of the body, and from the outside I looked at it carefully. The more I looked at it, the less I liked it. But then, I thought, there was nothing for it but to try once again. So again I squeezed uncomfortably into the slimy, cold thing, which was a Western body. With immense effort I tried to rise, but fell again, and then at last I managed to scramble somehow to my feet and pressed my back against that friendly tree. There was a sudden clatter from the house and a door was flung open. A woman came running out saying, "Oh, what have you done now? Come in and lie down." It gave me quite a shock. I thought of those two lamas with me and I was fearful that the woman might throw a fit at the sight of them, but obviously they were completely invisible to her, and that again was one of the surprising things of my life. I could always see these people who visited me from the astral, but if I talked to them and then some other person came in, well, the other person thought I was talking to myself, and I didn't want to get the reputation of being off my head. The woman came toward me and as she looked at me a very startled expression crossed her face. I really thought she was going to get hysterical, but she controlled herself somehow and put an arm across my shoulders. Silently I thought of how to control the body, and then very slowly, thinking a step at a time, I made my way into the house and went up the stairs, and flopped upon what was obviously my bed.